Robert Marcosello spent 37 years in the Philadelphia Fire Department, and from day one, he kept a journal. Now all those notes are in a book, A Firefighter's Journal.
I wanted to be a firefighter since I was 2 years old, and I got to live that dream. And I was a draftsman before that, studying to be an engineer. And I kind of, like, developed OCD. So when I got on the fire department, I felt compelled to document everything about my career. So I started a journal when I was in the fire academy. And that journal just followed me throughout my career. Book after book after book. And I wrote down all kinds of things that I witnessed, that I saw, how I felt about it, the wonderful people that I met in the fire department, my brother firefighters, my sister firefighters, and it was a lot of Philadelphia's notable incidents that I responded to. In the 1978 MOVE shootout, I was actually inside the compound during the entire shootout. Which was actually a good thing, because before that, I was standing right next to police officer Ramp, who was killed during that shootout. I responded to the 1975 Gulf Refinery disaster and lost a few good friends there. One in particular, Ralph Campana, was very good friends with him. We played softball that year almost once a week at, of all things, the Gulf Refinery field. The Pier 34 collapse was one of my first jobs when I came back out into the field from a staff assignment as a battalion chief. I was the second chief on the scene. Witnessed so many horrendous things. People under subway trains, shootings, stabbings, fire victims, too many to mention. The count must be around 100 or more. I mean, the book starts pretty much with a dream that haunted me for years about, I was a young lieutenant, and we responded to a fire. And I heard this man screaming as he died in the fire. And every few years after that, I would get that haunting dream with every detail. And that is kind of like the prologue of the book that I led into the book with. It was in the middle of the night that would wake me up, and that would follow the entire dream repeating itself with all the details. Almost from before it happened to the last second. And it bothered me. And, you know, I talked to people. And back then, we didn't have any what they call CISM now, which is Critical Incident Stress Management. There were no debriefings. I mean, on major incidents, after the Gulf Refinery fire, where we lost eight of our brother firefighters, we just went back to the firehouse and we went home. They have all kinds of stress debriefing and stuff like that. So it was different back then. So you either talk to your brother firefighters about it, or sometimes, you know, I could talk to my wife, but a lot of times I didn't want to drag her into it. So sometimes I just kept it bottled up, and I wrote how I felt in my journal. Maybe that was sort of a relief. But in that particular case, it didn't really didn't help. But it took years for that haunting dream to go away. You know, as I advanced through the ranks and went higher in position, and went back in my mind and replayed that fire where we lost a person, and I realized that we did do everything we could do, and we did it right. But, you know, when you're young, you just second-guess yourself about those things. I've seen some unbelievable acts by my brother and sister firefighters. Some very highly decorated people make some outstanding rescues, and you kind of like wonder how they did it. But, you know, to get that, to make that type of rescue, you need to be in the right place at the right time, or I guess from the victim's perspective, the wrong place at the wrong time. But as far as the rescues go, I don't think that I did any more than my brother and sister firefighters did. But I worked with some people that were decorated over and over again who went above and beyond. And to witness that sort of stuff was unbelievable. It was outstanding.
When did you decide to write the book?
After I retired.
After 37 years, right?
After 37 years on the job. When I retired, there were things in my book that I didn't want my family to see. Some of the things that we did, some of the things that I felt about, I just didn't want anybody to see. So I just start taking some of the better stories, the prologue story, the story called Screams. There was a story about a decomposing body that we had to get out of our house. I just start taking a few of those stories, and I start typing them, you know, putting them into a Word, and saving them that way. And the intent was to go through my journals in my spare time and pull out some of those stories and then maybe just get rid of my journals, which I still haven't done. And my son was over, and I made him read one or two of the stories, and he said, "Dad, you know, you should write a book." And I thought about it, and I said, "Oh, my God, that's a monumental task. I mean, I'm not a writer. I mean, my education was all in the sciences, not in in writing or journalism or literature." And I just started putting more and more stories together, and then I said, "Well, let me see if I could bridge these stories together in the form of a book." And I did that, and it just took me 5 years to do it, but I was always the type that once I put my mind to something, I did it, and I became obsessed with it, like everything else that I do when you have OCD. And 5 years later, the book was ready to be published. I mean, since I didn't have many journalism-type courses, I took some adult education courses in creative writing and how to get published and that sort of stuff, and that helped. And that's kind of like how the book came about. It's being sold on Amazon.com. You can also order it at any bookstore. They probably won't stock it because of the contractual issues with Amazon, but they can order it. I mean, I've walked into Barnes & Noble myself and asked if I could order the book, and they said yes. The title is A Firefighter's Journal, 37 Years on the Fire Grounds and in the Firehouses of Philadelphia. I ended as a deputy chief. When I left the job, I was responsible for half the city on a shift.
Wow.
There's two deputy chiefs in the city, one in the northern half and one in the southern half. I had the southern half, which covers the airport, the refineries, Center City, up to parts of North Philadelphia, all of West Philadelphia, all of South Philadelphia, all of Center City, parts of Kensington. And the north half covers the northeast, most of North Philadelphia, Germantown, Roxborough. One of the medical examiner's office was caught taking money from victims, if you remember back then. We started to get a plethora of calls to assist the private contractors in removing decomposing bodies. That was a real eye-opening experience. One of the chapters in the book is titled Decomp, based on one of those incidents. When I was a young kid, we used to crawl through the turnstiles and ride the subways for free in the summertime. Not exactly the legal way of getting on a train, but one of my biggest fears was falling under the train. And as a firefighter, we had to crawl under the trains several times to retrieve bodies and body parts. We were very heavily involved when I was a company officer and a young firefighter in emergency medical services. You name it, everything from overdoses to shootings and stabbings and cardiac arrest. And I pretty much, as a captain, moved into the field of hazardous materials. And that's kind of like what I gravitated to because of my scientific background. And I spent about 20 of those 37 years heavily involved in responding to hazardous materials incidents, which included the 2001 terrorist attacks, which involved the anthrax letters that were out there. And we start getting tons of calls for people who thought that they received a suspicious letter that Bin Laden was sending out, or whoever was sending out. And some of them were humorous. People like were so panicked that they were calling us for just about anything. I mean, one person was eating donuts and had the white powder on their pants. Thought all of a sudden it was anthrax. They ate the donut and went about their business in their office, and later on looked down in their pants, and maybe they were opening the mail, and they saw the white powder. So, I mean, when we did a sugar test, the sugar test was positive, and it wasn't anthrax, it was powdered sugar, and the evidence was right behind the person on the counter.
Wow.
Somebody called us to a food distribution terminal, said it was white powder all over grapes that were just shipped from South America, I believe it was. And when we investigated, the white powder was all gone. And it turns out that the white powder was frost from the refrigerated units in the ship. And when they took the grapes off the ship, it looked like they were coated with white powder. By the time we got there, in the warm July day, in the warmth of the sun, the powder was all gone. Water. When you're a firefighter, since you work such long shifts together, you eat meals together, you're a close-knit group, almost like the military in a small squad size or platoon size element, you become very close. And you do think of it pretty much as your second family. And you get to know everything about everybody, what's going on in their lives. And a lot of times if you have an issue and you go into the firehouse, like let's say you're remodeling something in your home and you're not exactly sure how to do it, you go into the firehouse and say, you know what, I was remodeling my house and I wasn't sure the best way to do this, that, or the other. Somebody's going to know, and somebody's going to give you the ideas and the opinions on how to do it, because somebody has that experience. So you become very close together, very, very family-like, family-oriented. And with that is the kidding, the practical jokes, the banter. And speaking of that stuff, I go into my book and some of the practical jokes that were pulled on me when I was a rookie firefighter. Some very humorous, trying to get you with buckets of water and tying a rope to your bed and pulling your bed through the dormitory room. And all of a sudden, you're moving at 25 miles an hour. And you go to bed and you find a mannequin in your bed or something, or you smell something that smells vaguely familiar and you weren't sure what it was. And next morning, when you go in the bathroom, you're covered head to toe in white powder. It turns out that somebody put talcum powder all over your sheets.
My God. I guess it relieves some of the tension.
It does. And especially the rookies. I guess in today's day and age, it would be considered more of a harassment. But you knew it and you accepted it as a rookie, that you were going to, you know, be the victim of practical jokes. And in the book, I talk about turning the tables on one of the practical jokes the first time I actually got the upper hand and did something to somebody. But it was all good natured. I mean, there was nothing serious that could harm anybody or anything like that. Now I work for Delaware County, the government, as a hazardous materials specialist, part-time. And I also teach at the Community College of Philadelphia. I was a fill-in chef. I mean, if it got to me, things were pretty bad.
You weren't known for your cooking?
No. But I learned a lot just by watching the firefighters. My wife still says I make some of the best fried potatoes to date.
Make some of the best what?
Home fries.
Oh. Fried potatoes.
And it's just from recipes that I picked up from firefighters that I work with. Some outstanding recipes. And one of the great things is you get to taste the cuisine of so many different cultures in the firehouse. And I was just talking yesterday. Yesterday I was down at the Wilmington Retired Firefighters Association, and we were talking about the same things, how we miss the firehouse meals. I mean, great meals. I mean, soup to nuts. Meals that you would pay a fortune for in a restaurant downtown that you got for $10 in a firehouse.
Wow.
Unbelievable stuff.
And who was the main chef? Who was the best cook, and how did they prove it? Like, did you sit down to dinner, and if everybody went, oh, my God, this is great, or...
Usually, every firehouse and every shift has somebody that gravitates towards being the cook. It's not an assigned duty or anything like that. Somebody just feels that they have better experience or watched their wives cook or learned from somebody else in the firehouse, and they take over the duties of doing it. Some of them, I mean, there's a few out there that are certified chefs that just happen to also be firefighters. And they cook these gourmet meals that will be something that you would see in a food magazine. Unbelievably. I mean, they look great. So,
did they print out little menus, or you just went in and whatever was being served, you ate?
Yeah, they just, whatever was being served. I mean, that's the one thing. You don't get a pass for having a special diet. It's you're in or you're out. Whatever the meal is. If you have a special diet, you bring something in or you refrain from the meal. They might cook you a little something special. So let's say you don't like onions in your potatoes or whatever. They might make a little bit without onions, but usually the meal is for everybody in the firehouse. And either you're in or you're out. And I got to say that most times everybody was in.
And did you slide down a fire pole that you see in movies?
There's actually a story in that, because I had 15 years on the job when I finally got transferred to a firehouse that had a pole. And the mistake I made is I was wearing a flannel shirt the first time I tried to go down, and it was for a fire. We were a fire call. And I was on the second floor, and I said, I looked at the pole. I was going towards the pole. I seen the first two firefighters to go down. I said, I could do this. And when I grabbed the pole, my long-sleeve flannel shirt just gave absolutely no friction to that pole, and I went down a little bit faster than I should have and hobbled my way under the fire truck, and we dashed out the door to go to the fire. But there aren't that many firehouses in Philadelphia that still have the poles. There might be one or two left that still have them. And in some of those cases, the officers have decided that it's not that good of an idea because firefighters were getting hurt going down the poles.
Right. You didn't get hurt, did you?
Well, I twisted my ankle. I didn't report the injury, and I hobbled to the fire truck.
That's terrible.
I went to the fire, and I just treated it at home with ice. And, I mean, speaking of injuries, as a young firefighter, I fell through a roof.
Really?
It was a stupid thing on my part. I mean, I just walked right into a hole. The other firefighters had cut the hole in the roof, and I was doing the inside search. I climbed up the ladder. I saw my company. I headed for them, and whoop, I went right down. And I landed on the head of another firefighter who was advancing a hose line inside. And that firefighter eventually became one of my favorite mentors when I got transferred to a firehouse to work with him. Here comes the airborne firefighter, because I had went through the roof and hole in the roof and landed right on his head.